Welcome to the Class of 1987 podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. On this podcast, we will be speaking with members of the Yale College Class of 1987 about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We plan to cover a wide range of topics and have people who represent the full range of our class's experience. The class of 1987 is the best class that Yale College has ever had, and we're here to celebrate that. So sit back and listen to what your classmates have to say. And welcome to the latest edition of the Y87 podcast. With me today is our classmate, Catherine Slusser. Welcome. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Tim?
I am good. Sitting here in not so sunny New York. And where are you?
I'm in Philadelphia, also no sun, and it's really cold.
Well, it is the fall when we're recording this. So can you just tell everybody, what are you up to these days? What are you doing in Philadelphia?
Sure. Well, I'm an actor and I'm doing that. And I've also recently transitioned to being an actor and a professor. So that's my new gig right now, is that I am a professor. I'm an associate professor of theater at Bryn Mawr College, right outside of Philadelphia.
And how long have you been doing the professor gig?
So the professor gig is actually a long-standing thing. I was an adjunct for 20 years, you know, teaching a course here or there whenever I was in a place for long enough. My career as an actor has meant that I travel and I'm in different places all the time doing shows here and there, including Europe and back. And so it's been really fun. But whenever I was like based somewhere for a considerable amount of time, I would the adjunct. I've been teaching at Bryn Mawr for 12 years, and I've been a tenured professor for a half a year. Before that...
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
The tenure part is new. That's great.
Yeah, that is new. So in Bryn Mawr College's 135-year history, I'm actually the first person hired as an assistant professor on the tenure track in the arts, and the first faculty member in the performing arts to go through the tenure review process.
So that was probably no small feat.
It was no small feat.
So I have a bunch of questions about this. First of all, what made you go down this particular path of trying to create a tenured spot where there had never been one before?
So interestingly, one of my colleagues at Bryn Mawr has tenure, but he had just never been through the tenure process. He'd just been there for so long that they were like, you know what? You are tenured. So it was a very investigated journey that he went on. So the idea to have me was a new thought. And I've always been a teacher as well as an actor. Actually, my work study job at Yale, I taught. There was the U.S. Grant program.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I taught for U.S. Grant every year from sophomore year on. I taught in their creative writing after school. And I loved it. It was great. And then when I was first acting in New York, one of my very first survival jobs was I taught for the Princeton Review. I taught SAT prep. That led me down a really strange pathway where I was supposed to go teach with the Princeton Review in Tokyo. They just opened a school. And then at the last minute, they didn't take me because they didn't have the enrollment they thought they would have. And instead of going to Tokyo, being homeless and all my stuff in storage, got a job teaching in Turkey. And so I went and I taught in Istanbul, middle school, for a year.
Hmm. So acting is taking you and teaching is taking you to different places. How do you think about the place of performing arts in a liberal arts education? Because you're at a quintessential liberal arts institution. So how does it fit in?
Great. Well, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that because as I was making this case for why I was essential and why tenured professors in the arts are essential, I had to make a case for what that should be. Looking at the idea of liberal arts, it comes from the Latin root liber, to free, and my greatest hope for my students is that the study of theater and acting and the arts will help to liberate their minds and to free them from the idea of an answer-based education. I believe that we go to university not to get the answers, but to come up with the questions. So if all we're doing is getting answers, then we could just really learn it by just reading a bunch of books. But I think that the reason that we go to a liberal arts institution is not because we know we're going to be a lawyer, say, or an actor, but because we're interested in understanding humanity. Theater helps to propel students toward deeper questions and deeper curiosities. I talk to my students about theater being a curiosity engine, that it helps to form agile minds, and it does this by teaching people how to dissect metaphor and to imagine new worlds and to step into new perspectives. And I think that this curiosity that is developed in the arts helps in no matter what major a student chooses. So you don't have to major in theater or think that you want to be a theater artist in order to take theater, but everything depends on questioning, on the imagination, on thinking in new ways. We cannot create new worlds, new experiments, new vaccines, unless we can imagine them. One of my favorite scholars, thinkers about education is bell hooks. And she writes that the function of art is to do more than to tell it like it is. It's to imagine what's possible. And we cannot imagine if we don't learn to question and we don't learn to wonder.
So in what ways have the roles you've had since college expanded your mind or changed your imagination?
The act of creating a character requires you to literally try on a different way of thinking, a different way of seeing the world, a different way of communicating. And through that process, you're developing different ways of seeing and knowing. And I think that every role I've done has created that journey for me. I mean, from things like I played Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. She is this frustrated woman who has spent her life thwarted. Like, really, she has a brilliant mind. And because she was a woman at the time that she was a woman, she was not able to actually use her mind in the ways that she should have been able to do so. And so just being in that constricted and confined place in order to find Martha's, her drinking and the ways that she berates her husband and herself and plays games with people, all came from this constriction, the societal constriction. And I think in that, I start to understand how that harms all of us, no matter what box we're put into. We're all somewhat typed or stereotyped or put into boxes. And when we're in those boxes, it's like this little dark world, right? It's just your no windows. And so that frustration, that rage that I found in Martha, I see in the world today, the rage of folks who haven't had the same opportunities as other people, the ways that we oppress different folks. And that's a way, that's an example of imagination growing.
Sure, sure.
I just played this crazy, crazy play called Not I by Sam Beckett. It's the play, people who don't know the title, they'll at least know it's the play that's just a woman's mouth. And it's supposed to be just a woman's mouth. And it's a 15-minute play. It's supposed to be done swiftly, and it's nonlinear. And the way that this woman's mind thinks, it just keeps wrapping around and wrapping around. It's really hard to memorize. A lot of actors who've done it didn't memorize it. They just like wore a little earpiece and they got cheats.
Got their lines.
Yeah, got their lines through their earpiece. I, of course, have to do it all the way. I learned the piece, and the process of learning a piece for me, it takes that metaphor. When you learn something by heart, you carry it in your heart. And until you learn it by heart, you can't really know it. And you can't really play it in my mind. You have to have it inside of you and you have to be inside of it. Mm-hmm. So in learning Not I, only way I could learn it was to make sense of what had has always been considered to be somewhat garbled language, crazy language, eddies. She speaks in circular eddies. So the process of understanding where those eddies might lead and what is trying to be processed in this 15-minute piece brought me to a place I never would have imagined. And I was able to metaphorically place different pieces of her story in different parts of my body, so that even though it's the stillest, it's just the mouth.
Just the mouth.
It lived so completely in my body, in different places, in different ways in my body. And I've learned a lot from doing that role and from being in that, again, that restricted place. She lives alone. She doesn't speak except a couple of times a year. And when she does, it's just this spew. And this monologue or this play is essentially the spew. And it got me thinking about COVID, about isolation, about the quarantine, this period that we're all coming through. But it also got me thinking about like the mouse as the vessel for the virus. So it's like the scariest piece of us at the moment.
Right.
And it's also this way that we connect. And so it just, how I was able to put those things together that made me rethink and reimagine this current world that we've been through, especially thinking about the elderly who might have been in a retirement home, et cetera, and really isolated from everybody they had known. How difficult that is.
Yeah, really, really brutal. I have an elderly father and it was difficult for him.
Oh, yeah, it's just brutal.
The vaccines were truly liberating in that regard.
Right.
In this world of where people are trying to figure out where they are and what they can represent and what they can take on, particularly in the acting, how do you think about the roles that you are willing to take on, want to take on, and how do you help your students think about the same things? Can you represent a man? Can you represent on stage someone who is completely different than you are? And where do you draw the lines and where you won't go?
Good question. I actually have had a subspecialty in portraying men, interestingly enough. I've never been an actor who thinks about those roles that you just have to play. And I thought there was something wrong with me because I haven't had this like, oh yes, if I just need to play this role and then I will be content.
If it can only be Ophelia, then yes, my career is overdone.
That's right. It's just never really been the way I think about art making and my work.
Yeah, and if you look at it like a Hamilton, which completely redefined who could play a founding father.
Right, exactly.
For instance, like that's why I asked the questions, like how do you think about what's even possible? You're at a historically all women's college.
Right.
And now we're dealing with gender fluidity and some gender roles, and it's a time where theater can really help people explore that and maybe eliminate some of the boundaries that existed before.
Well, yeah, right? Especially you brought up Ophelia, especially with Shakespeare, because when you have Shakespeare plays, of course, Shakespeare was writing for men and the female parts in Shakespeare's plays were played by young boys. And I think that's part of why there are so many more male roles in Shakespeare than female. And that's a big barrier for a lot of people. But I've had this interesting and really exciting phase of my life, which has been happening, where I've been getting to play all of these incredible Shakespearean men. So I played Lear recently, both in Iceland and in the States. And I played Prospero. And I've been thinking about other male Shakespeare heroes I would like to play. And there are many. I do think it is a way that we can get to know the experiences of others. I don't tend to think of my playing, for example, when I played Prospero, there's a whole school of like, if a woman is going to play a typically male-gendered role, then you change it. So they made a movie where Prospero was played by a woman and it was Prospera, and all the references were changed and it was a she. And I chose to think about Prospero as a character, not as a gender. And so Prospero was Prospero, and Prospero's relationship to Miranda, the child, was a parent. I'm the parent and this is my child. And that even though what bearing a child, carrying a child in utero is different from how a man experiences parenthood, it quickly becomes really similar. And so just thinking about the role of Prospero as a parent, not as a particularly as a gender, was really important to me. And the same thing for Lear. Lear was Lear. It wasn't male Lear, it was Lear. There are certain boundaries that I think are important at the moment. There's been a big backlash in the world of theater and the art of acting about who gets to play what. So who gets to play what roles? And I think that there's a lot of that that's righteous, because for a while, white people got to play everything. And it was like, oh yeah. I mean, in the bad old days, white people would wear blackface and say, yes, I can be Othello. We haven't done that for a long time. But even so, there's a way in which we think of the white person's journey and experience as the norm, and everybody else's experiences are specialty experiences that are just different from what regular people have. Mm-hmm. So that is not me speaking. That is the way that I think the world thought about race and gender for a long time. So there's been some taking back of roles and representation and saying, you know what, for a long time, say trans folks were not represented on stage except by cisgendered people pretending or acting as if they were trans. And so there's not been representation of trans folks playing trans folks. They've just pretty much been shut out. So there's a lot of argument, a lot of thinking right now about where do we draw the line? Who does get to play what role? And how do we make these choices?
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Please remember that this podcast is being brought to you by the 35th reunion of the greatest class Yale College has ever known, the great class of 1987. Our reunion will be in New Haven, Connecticut, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Pearson College. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the conversation.
How do you wrestle with that with your students?
That's such a good question. We just did this really interesting thing. In one of the classes that I'm teaching, it's a more advanced acting class, and the class is focused on Michael Chekhov technique, which is a particular way of looking at theater and acting. But we're using two plays as the playground for this Michael Chekhov technique. So the plays I invited my students to play with on this playground are The Three Sisters by Anton Chekhov and this response play, which is just, I actually don't know when it was written, maybe 2019, by Nigerian-British playwright. It's also called The Three Sisters. His last name is Elams, Inua Elams. He has taken Chekhov's play and reset it in Nigeria during the Civil War, the Biafran Civil War, and everyone in it is Nigerian. It follows Chekhov's story really closely, except in this like critical way, which is the given circumstances. We had a big discussion in my class about how do we handle this as various races in my class, what do we do? Is it okay in an educational setting to take on this work, even though it is not our story to tell and it is not written for us? And we had this excellent, wonderful discussion from all of my brilliant students about how do you explore another culture, another world, through the medium of theater, if what we're saying is you're not allowed to actually get in there and dig around the way we do with other plays. I happen to have one student in my class who's Nigerian from Lagos, which is in the play, and she listened as we were all talking about this, and then she said, I want to do this play. It is important for me to do this play. It is important for me to have you do this play with me. I want you to walk alongside me as we examine the Biafran Civil War and learn about my country. It was really important for my, especially the white students who were the most hesitant to try on this play, to hear that from Wura's mouth, that if what we're thinking about right now in academia is amplifying voices of those who've not been heard from for a while, then we really need to listen when a Nigerian student says, I need you to do this play with me. I know that you would not be cast in this play in the world, but part of how I learn about you is by being in a play that was written for people like you, and I need you to learn about me in the same way.
I think it goes to a comment you made just a few minutes ago and the fundamental question of art. Who did the writer write it for? The writer could have, in this instance, his mind that there were certain kinds of actors who would play the roles, but, and this is just a question, did the author have an idea of who the audience should be? And maybe the kind of communication that your student was talking about was precisely what he had in mind. And maybe it wasn't, I don't know, but that's sort of the tricky thing with art, is that what the artist intends sometimes isn't nearly apparent. And then the responsibility you have to take with the art is what you do with it.
Right, right. He lives in England, and the first production of it was actually at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And it's meant to be, the original production of it, I think, was all with Black Brits were in it. And it's meant for Black folks, not for white folks to do. I think that that's important. And also, as a tool in the classroom, as something to explore in the classroom, I think it's a slightly different story.
Oh, I guess the context does matter. It's what stage is it on?
Right, exactly. And really important to have these conversations. They're the hardest conversations to have. I started off my class with, okay, so I'm this middle-aged white lady, and I'm super awkward, and I need your help. Like, how are we going to talk about this together, and how are we going to figure out a plan for moving forward with this play? I mean, we could, in one scenario, say only folks with dark skin can do this play, and the rest of you, we're going to stick with Anton Chekhov's Three Sisters. And that would have been fine. And then I had an anonymous form that the students could write in additional thoughts. And then if they wanted to opt out of doing it, they just needed to tell me. And so today I actually handed out scenes to my class from both plays. It's really cool, actually. They're from the same moment in the two plays, so that they can see, oh, this is what Elums did, this is what Chekhov did. And it's just, it's going to be really interesting and really cool to do. And we have to keep talking. That's really crucial, is just to listen to people who are smarter than I am and to keep talking and keep asking questions. How do we proceed? How do we move on? How do we go forward? I like to think, like, students always have this idea that somehow acting is like, you go away and you're Hamlet, right? So that Hamlet is there. And it's important for them and for me to remember that there has never been a definitive Hamlet. We don't say, okay, we figured it out. Now let's put that play aside and we can move on. That's not what's interesting about the play. What's interesting about the play is the character of Hamlet in whatever time you happen to be in. So I'm not thinking, okay, there's a solve for who Hamlet is. It's always an attempt. It's just like, it's jumping in. Okay, I'm going to jump in here and see what I find. So that I think about the process of working on a character. I'm here in Philadelphia and my character's in Los Angeles, say, and over the course of rehearsing a play, I am walking toward my character, and it's really slow, and I'm walking toward my character is also walking toward me. And where we meet becomes the performance. So I'm never just Catherine, and I'm never just Hamlet. I'm always this Venn diagram of Catherine and Hamlet. And what gets illuminated, what gets amplified, what gets seen is what that particular combination brings and what my choices bring to the character. in a way, plays are like this really cool blueprint, and we are looking at what's in between. We are building the connective tissue. That's the way that language works. It's part of what we're communicating. It's not the entirety of that. And that's one of the things I love about both performing myself and also teaching acting, is seeing those moments when a student finds the character in them and that interesting perspective on the character comes forward. It's really exciting.
Must be an exciting moment. Mm-hmm. So how much does your teaching impact your acting and your acting impact your teaching? Is it complete symbiosis or is it somewhat separate?
Oh, it's crazy how much they affect each other. It's crazy. I mean, one of the things that's crazy is that my students come to see me perform. And so you better do what you're teaching. You know, it's like the ultimate, like, is she actually doing what she's told us to do? There's something that's really exciting and also somewhat frightening about your students just showing up and seeing put your money where your mouth is. I learn so much from my students, and I also learn a lot just from trying to explain what it is that I'm thinking. So yeah, it's always showing up in my work. And then what I've just done, I'll reach, for example, this play that I was just talking about, Not I, that I just recently did. I was exploring something new in working on it, where we talk about acting in terms of action. So what are you doing? And in the old days, we put it into this form of, I want to hurt you. I want to embrace you. I want to punish you. So the you being the other person in the scene. And I've been exploring with the you as actually a variable, so that it could be you, the other person in the scene. It could be myself. I want to comfort myself. Mm-hmm. But it could also be an object, an idea. I want to encourage hope. I want to lacerate the heavens, so that it's not something that's just right there, but it can be, it changes how these moments work together and how we can thread through. And with Not I, something I was experimenting with was, rather than constantly changing the action that I was playing, I was changing the why, the you. So it was, I want to discover you, or let's see, I want to threaten God. I want to threaten myself. I want to threaten my foot. I want to threaten somebody else. So that it was traveling the where as opposed to how I was doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially if you're going to have someone who's got an eddy kind of back and forth with their thinking.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And so that's something then I can discover and then bring into my class and say, let's try this. Let's see where we can go with this.
So we're got to the point where we're in our lightning round, where I'm going to ask you some rapid fire questions.
Oh, no.
Yes, here we go.
Okay.
In your opinion, what is the most underrated show ever put on? What's the most underrated play or musical? I don't care what kind of stage show. What's the most underrated one?
What's the most underrated play or musical? Oh, gosh. Timon of Athens.
Is there a show that you think everyone must see once in their life?
First of all, everybody has to see theater. There's this way in which now we have students coming into the classroom thinking it's all about movies and TV and that people are just heads, basically. And there's something about the liveness of theater that has been essential post pandemic.
Oh, I completely agree.
You have to see live theater and be live.
Yes, I saw live music again, and it was just transformative. I was just like, oh, I forgot what this could be.
Right? And it's not just you. It's like breathing with people who are feeling the heartbeats and the pulse and the breath of those around you.
Oh, yeah.
Witnessing music.
And we were in pouring rain, and no one cared. It's just the musicians were putting on the show. It was pouring rain. I'm just like caked with mud. Mm-hmm. You know what? It was just so joyous to be there together. I completely agree.
I was just at the Philadelphia Orchestra for the first time in a couple of years. And it was like somebody lit every single player on fire. They were so happy to be playing for a live audience, and the audience was just eating it up in a way that I've just never, it was like everybody breathed as one. It was so exciting.
That sounds great.
And, you know, it's funny, ever since I started doing theater a billion years ago, the end of theater has been predicted, you know, even before I started doing theater. It's like, oh, movies are here now. That's so much more interesting. Theater's dead. Now we have streaming. Theater's dead. And each time theater survives, and I think the reason it survives is precisely that that palpable liveness, that here we are, it's right here, it's in the room that we lacked during the pandemic.
All right, last question. So as an educator, now that you've been an adjunct at many places, you're a professor at an excellent institution down in Philadelphia, what aspect of Yale do you think every secondary college institution should have? What part of your Yale experience do you think everyone should get?
They all should get Morse. Sorry, that's
really... No, that's okay. Completely fair.
Be biased. The thing I loved the most about Yale, this is so lame, but it was the dining hall conversations, hanging out at those tables and just like stumbling upon different kinds of interests that you never knew people could have or would have, and learning little tidbits here and there. Yeah, the dining halls were essential.
I completely agree. I could have traded, I can't remember most of my professors, but I remember a lot of dining hall conversations.
I always tell that to my students. They're like, which classes should I take? Which classes should I take? And there's a little bit more of current students of thinking it's somehow the price they pay for their career. So there's this career oriented, well, I have to major in this, otherwise I won't get. And it's almost never the case. I've said to my students time and again, no one at an audition ever has asked me what I majored in, ever. It has not come up. It is not important. That you should take classes that make your heart sing or make you curious, or because you don't know anything about it. And the fact is, after college, you will forget most of what you learned. You will. But what you remember is the passion.
Exactly.
The passion you felt, and you remember the passion that your professors had.
Yeah, and the intellectual muscles you've developed, now you can apply them.
Yes, which is the curiosity thing again, which is why it's so important, because you've learned how to think. You've learned how to ask questions. I was just this past weekend, one other thought, I was just at my daughter's family weekend. She goes to Smith, another traditionally female institution, and she's just like in heaven. It's such a great school. We were really, really happy. But one of the things that made me the happiest was I went to their new library. They just have had a massive renovation that's been going on for the past couple of years. And it was renovated by Maya Lin, who was, when I took Scully, Maya Lin was the TA.
Oh, wow.
Like the connection through... She was a senior at Yale when she designed the Vietnam War Memorial. Then to see this library, like, well, her mature career that she built as a thank you, really, for Smith accepting her mom, who escaped China, communist China, to go to the United States. And it's just this beautiful story. But this is the most incredible space I have ever been to. And one of the reasons I knew how to appreciate it, aside from just appreciating it, was from the passion I felt for architecture learned in Vincent Scully's class. And it's just anybody who's in Massachusetts needs to go see this library. You will not be sad.
Well, on that, I will say thank you very much for spending time, and so look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
I hope we get to see you in June at a reunion.
Yay. I look forward to seeing you as well.
In a world where people were isolated by a pandemic, forced to live their lives remotely in an endless parade of Zoom meetings, one Yale College class dared to break the mold. The Yale College class of 1987 is planning what no Yale College class has ever tried before, at least not for a while, an in-person reunion, June 2nd 3rd, 4th, and 5th, 2022, we will be gathering in Pearson College. Be there for engaging discussions, nightly revelry, and way too much New Haven pizza, if there ever could be such a thing. We'll wrestle with age-old questions like, maybe I look better in a mask, what do you think? Who or what is a Bula? What in the world am I going to do with no kids in the house? These questions and more will be answered at our 35th college reunion. Be there. That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 Podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.